And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And as the greatest nation on God's green earth, do we have an obligation? Do we have a moral duty to try to save the Ukraine as an independent nation, as a beacon of democratic principles and Western values being threatened right now by a very aggressive and very unrepentant Russian dictator? That is the question that is going to be decided in the next few days by the House of Representatives and the Senate of the United States. On the Senate side, there are now 18 Republican senators who are joining virtually all the Democrats in supporting aid to Ukraine. But what is the issue at the core? The issue at the core is appeasement. That's the theme of an extremely persuasive new column that just appeared in the Wall Street Journal. It is a column by Casey Michel, who is the director of the Combating Kleptocracy Program at the Human Rights Foundation. His first book is called American Kleptocracy: How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. It's out now from St. Martin's Press. He has a second book on the way. It'll be released later this year. It is called Foreign Agents: How American Lobbyists and Lawmakers Threaten Democracy Around the World. Casey, to begin, what are some of the key ways in which our situation regarding Ukraine compares to the situation in 1938 regarding Czechoslovakia?
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. Thanks so much for having me today and obviously talking about this this topic. You know, everyone knows there are clear differences between Vladimir Putin and Adolf Hitler. I don't need to go into all those differences right here, not least that, you know, the lack of death camps that are killing millions in Russia or in Russian-occupied territory. Clearly, there's plenty of daylight. But even though there is daylight, there are still plenty of similarities between where we are now and what we see in Moscow and where we were in 1938 and what we saw out of Berlin. These are two leaders, two dictators, that rose to power on the back of conspiracy theories, entrenched their dictatorships domestically by focusing on neo-imperialist ambitions and focusing, above all, about returning their countries to what they see as their rightful place as great power status, and then all the while shattering the country, shattering the democracies that are surrounding them, using a similar rhetoric aimed at supposedly saving ethnic comrades abroad, playing this kind of defense as offense, or if you want to flip that, offense as defense, that unfortunately far too many in a weak-willed West seem to be buying in, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's a lot easier not to fight than it is to fight. And unfortunately, the lesson from 1938 is that if you give these dictators what they say they want, whether it's land in Czechoslovakia or elsewhere, they're just going to come back for more. I mean, this was one of, if not the key lessons in the lead up to the Second World War. If you give a dictator that's already on the march land, territory, people, they don't stop there. They do not stop at that first request. They always, always, always want more, which is exactly what's going to happen if Donald Trump comes to power. And the first thing he does is give Vladimir Putin parts of the Ukrainian territory that the Russians already occupy.
Well, again, it's a very similar situation. Hitler never claimed that he wanted to gobble up all of Czechoslovakia. He just wanted the Sudetenland, which was about a third of the country. That was heavily populated, predominantly populated by German speakers. When you talk about Donald Trump, and the headline that they use in the Wall Street Journal for your column is Trump's Russia policy is appeasement. Is that based on Trump's promise that he will end this war in 24 hours? Is there some way that he could, quote, end the war other than appeasing Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, Michael, look, you're exactly right. Obviously, the column goes further into detail on this, but in recent months, we've seen Trump beginning to flesh out what his Ukraine or maybe his Russia policy itself would be regarding Ukraine. He has already said that it might be a good idea to let Russia, quote unquote, take over parts of Ukraine, including the parts that are already occupied. And of course, he did say he would solve the problem in 24 hours. Unfortunately for the rest of us, the only way to do that, to quote unquote solve the problem, would be to give Vladimir Putin everything that he wants. And I think it's worth taking a step back and remembering that this is not a fight that is going to end tomorrow. I mean, look, I would love for there to be a 24-hour solution for the Ukrainians to retake all of their territory, for Putin, he doesn't even necessarily need to be ousted, just, you know, sufficiently chastened and, you know, welcomed back into the broader kind of body politic of the international world. But that's not going to happen. With a leader like Putin in power in Moscow, this war is only going to continue. And the only way to solve it, again, using Trump's language, in 24 hours would be to give Putin everything that he wants. But then even after that, Putin would still come back asking for more. So I think Trump, everything else aside, completely misunderstands, completely misreads the situation. And I would say, frankly, that's a generous reading of his position.
Why was appeasement so popular among much of certainly the British and even the American public, to the extent that we were following what was going on in Europe in 1938? Why was appeasement so popular in the 30s, and why does it appear to have some popular appeal right now?
Yeah, there were a couple elements that were unique to that period that are a little different from where we are now, but certainly plenty of similarities. I mean, I think we have to, if we go back to the mid-late 1930s, I mean, we're looking at a continent in Europe that was only 20 years removed from the most horrific war they had ever seen. And so even though hindsight is, of course, 2020, you can see the logic. You can almost feel the kind of empathy for those leaders that are trying to find some tool to avoid any kind of reprise of that kind of bloodshed, that kind of devastation. And I think, you know, folks in London, certainly led by Neville Chamberlain at the time, who's the closest, most closely associated with appeasement, he also knew full well that the Brits not only would not be able to physically defend Czechoslovakia as they had agreed to, but even beyond that, the Brits were frankly in no standing at the time to actually fight Germany. Neville Chamberlain was, everything else also aside, trying to buy the Brits time as well as the French in order to rearm themselves, because they had really missed the forest for the trees of what Hitler truly wanted and, again, the threat that Hitler truly represented. Now, fast forward to where we are here in the mid-2020s, and you can also see similar patterns playing out in Europe, which including much of Western Europe, which has failed to rearm, failed to actually sufficiently arm itself to potentially push back against a Russian threat itself. Whereas in the United States of America, and again, similar to where things were in the 1930s, I think, unfortunately, a lot of folks, and maybe even Trump included, see this only as a territorial disagreement in Europe, that this is not our issue, it's not our territory. It is, to paraphrase Neville Chamberlain, a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. And again, if you squint, you can see that argument, but again, it's just missing everything that this is about. This was never about specific provinces, specific territories in eastern Ukraine or in southern Ukraine that are filled with Russian speakers. This was always about far, far more than, frankly, Putin has been telling us about for years. We just choose to ignore it.
His desire to rebuild the old Soviet empire. I've been fascinated by the fact that he also is very critical of his predecessors in Russian leadership who sold Alaska to the United States in 1867. He believes that should be ideally Russian territory as well, though I'm not sure he's planning any kind of military strike in that direction. Casey Michel, a great column, Trump's Russia Policy is Appeasement. It's posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. I hope you'll continue the conversation with us, Casey Michel. We will, on the MedVed Show, be right back.
Receive 50% off by becoming a MedHead member.
Michael, I'm an enthusiastic fan of yours. I'm a MedHead.
Join now at michaelmedved.com.
And on the Michael Medved show, having just spoken a little bit about some of the dangers of appeasement, appeasement as a policy is the idea that if you want to give an aggressive dictator what he wants, or I guess what she wants, if we have ever have aggressive dictators of the female persuasion, that's a way to achieve peace and stability and to avoid conflict. And some of the difficulty in doing that with Vladimir Putin was extraordinarily apparent last night in the television interview with Tucker Carlson and with Vladimir Putin. There was one very positive thing to which I give Tucker Carlson some credit. He brought up the issue of Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter who has been imprisoned for more than a year by the Russians on claims of espionage, which are clearly fallacious and baseless. And Putin indicated, oh, yes, we would consider a prisoner trade. But you see, a prisoner trade for somebody who has been tried, not for phony charges, but for real charges of espionage, and in this case of arms dealing, someone who Putin apparently wants to release who is being held in German prisons. It's very much like the situation with the Hamas killers and terrorists wanting to trade completely innocent civilian hostages who they kidnapped, and again, some of them children, some of them old people, though, to trade those hostages for people who went through a legal process and were convicted of terrorism, in some cases convicted of murder or attempted murder or very serious crimes. And, of course, they don't want the trade to be one-on-one. They want it to be, we'll take three liberated terrorists for one innocent Israeli. In any event, that's a different conflict. Putin tried to explain to the American audience that he assumed would be a huge audience for Tucker Carlson. He tried to explain what started the conflict in Ukraine. Clip 8.
So what was the trigger for you? What was the moment where you decided you had to do this?
Initially, it was the coup in Ukraine that provoked the conflict. By the way, back then the representatives of three European countries, Germany, Poland, and France, arrived. They were the guarantors of the signed agreement between the government of Yanukovych and the opposition. They signed it as guarantors. Despite that, the opposition committed a coup, and all these countries pretended that they didn't remember that they were guarantors of the peaceful settlement. They just threw it in the stove right away, and nobody recalls that.
Okay, what he's talking about is Yanukovych, who he mentions was a Putin pawn whose election campaign had been dubious. The opponent, his opponent in the election, had been drugged and been attacked. And by the way, there's another thing here. He also made the allegation, Vladimir Putin, that Zelensky's father had fought for the Nazis in World War II. Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's pretty unusual given the fact that Zelensky is Jewish and his father was Jewish, but his father was also born in 1947, all right, which would have made it a little bit difficult to actually be fighting for the Nazis before you were born. But Putin also offered some talking points that he seemed to borrow directly from J.D. Vance, senator from Ohio, and a few other American pro-Putin conservatives. Listen, this is clip 5.
Do the United States need this? What for? Thousands of miles away from your national territory. Don't you have anything better to do? You have issues on the border, issues with migration, issues with the national debt, more than $33 trillion. You have nothing better to do, so you should fight in Ukraine? Wouldn't it be better to negotiate with Russia, make an agreement, already understanding the situation that is developing today?
Okay, wouldn't it be better not to attack your neighbor and to be responsible for an estimated 360,000 casualties, which they've reported the Russian Federation has suffered? Then Tucker Carlson asked Putin if he's achieved his high-minded goals. This is clip six.
I mean, have you achieved your aims?
No, we haven't achieved our aims yet, because one of them is denazification. This means the prohibition of all kinds of neo-Nazi movements. This is one of the problems that we discussed during the negotiation process, which ended in Istanbul early this year.
Okay, denazification, and again, it is ironic that a government in Eastern Europe that has a history, by the way. Ukraine does have a history of intense anti-Semitism going back to the 1600s. But the fact is that it's not part of this government or the leadership that Ukraine has now. Or, by the way, the growing Jewish community that has been very supportive of Ukraine's struggle for continued existence. In the middle of the campaign, Putin said the war could end tomorrow. How would that work? Trump has promised he could do it. This is clip seven.
If you really want to stop fighting, you need to stop supplying weapons. It will be over within a few weeks. That's it. And then we can agree on some terms. Before you do that, stop. What's easier? Why would I call him? What should I talk to him about? Or beg him for what?
And what messages do you get back?
You're going to deliver such and such weapons to Ukraine? Oh, I'm afraid, please don't. What is there to talk about?
Do you think NATO is worried about this becoming a global war or a nuclear conflict?
At least that's what they're talking about. And they're trying to intimidate their own population with an imaginary Russian threat.
With an imaginary Russian threat. How is it only imaginary? Meanwhile, in the face of all of these threats, there are more politicians making surprise decisions on the Republican side. In particular, we will get to that coming up on the Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, honored to welcome to the show Tim Alberta, who is a marvelous writer. I've commended his work before, and in particular, his brand new best-selling book that has zoomed, right to the top of the bestseller lists. The book is called The Kingdom, The Power, and the Glory. Those phrases may sound a little bit familiar from the Lord's Prayer. The subtitle, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. Tim, let me ask you at the very beginning, were you surprised at all about the immediate success and bestseller status of your book about Christian conservatives in America?
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm more like shocked, actually. I was quite surprised because it's just not necessarily a blockbuster genre of publishing. And you know, in fact, without getting into the details or naming names or anything, there was, I think fair to say, quite a bit of hesitancy around even publishing this book, you know, from when I had first conceived of the project and pitched it, because it was not necessarily seen as something with mass appeal. And that was, honestly, that was fine with me. I never really visualized this as some kind of a chart topper. It was really more of a passion project and something that I felt strongly about personally. So the commercial success and the great reception has been a very pleasant surprise. But that's it's really not why I set out to write the book.
Well, again, you begin the book about 5 years ago in July of 2019, in what you describe as the worst day of your life, which was the day that your father died. Your father was a distinguished member of clergy. He was a pastor. He was very much an evangelical Christian. If he were alive today, some 5 years after he died, what do you think his reaction would be to the direction recently of the Christian conservative movement in this country?
Boy, I turn that question over in my brain multiple times a day, I think. You know, the thing is, I think my dad, like many in the evangelical world, sort of came to a certain peace with voting for Donald Trump in 2016 because of a certain set of issues that they felt very strongly about, and they knew that Trump was a deeply flawed individual and someone who they didn't necessarily trust, but they also viewed rolling the dice on him as preferable to voting for Hillary Clinton. And I think, you know, over the course of Donald Trump's first couple of years in office, there was some obvious buyer's remorse from people like my dad, but I think also a certain level of, I guess I would just almost define it as combativeness, a kind of a refusal to back down from you know their support for Trump, and feeling really, I think, almost marginalized by the attacks on Trump, and feeling as though attacks on his character were ipso facto an attack on the character of those who voted for him. And so I think in many ways, even as we maintained a very healthy, loving, respectful relationship as father and son, our very sharp divergence on the question of Donald Trump and his fitness for office, and certainly his behavior and his rhetoric, you know, it became something of a painful thing for us. And, you know, I'd like to think that my dad, being a man of integrity and someone who takes his faith very, very seriously, would have, by the time of the 2020 election and certainly today, come around to understanding just how unfit Donald Trump is for the office of the presidency. At least that's what I tell myself, and that may well be a self-soothing exercise, but I want to believe that that's where he would have landed.
Reading your book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, it would seem that the one compromise or the one position that startles you most, surprises you most, motivates the writing of this book, has to do with support for a lot of deeply religious people, people profoundly committed to the church and to the wisdoms of Scripture, and to people in that camp who ended up supporting January 6th and believing that the people who attacked police officers at the Capitol building, injuring 140 of them, the idea that those people were heroes. There are even prominent evangelical Christian spokespeople who said they would have died to try to overturn the election, that this was a cause worth giving your life to. That came as something of a shock, didn't it?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard to quantify some of the support for not necessarily for Donald Trump, but for, I think I would categorize it as more of a militant, you know, blood and soil, God and country, Christian nationalist approach to our politics and to our culture. And, you know, the degree to which you have seen sort of these episodes like January 6th, or even I would say in the 2 month period between the election being lost in November of 2020, and then of course culminating in January 6th, some of the polling around QAnon and other conspiracy theories, polling on the question of political violence and whether or not it's justified. I think as we've attempted to quantify and to understand the depths of these sentiments and you know how real of a danger it is, that was perhaps the most striking thing for me in all of my reporting and my research, was just understanding that while I do believe on the one hand that this represents nowhere near a majority of the white evangelical world, and I do not think that it has overtaken or hijacked the institutions of evangelicalism per se, I do believe that the threat is larger and is more significant than I recognized earlier, or perhaps more so than I was comfortable acknowledging earlier. I do think that in that sense, it was a real wake-up call for me.
And the message for turning evangelical community back to core principles, the most important priority?
Well, listen, this is you know, in humility and in love, the message that I've tried to convey with the book, which is that for the outside world who may not know Christ, they get a pass. I don't expect anybody to understand what I might be talking about if they are not themselves a born-again believing Christian. But if they are, and if you are listening to this right now in your car, in your office, or wherever, I think it must be understood that your first priority and your true identity is as a follower of Jesus Christ. And that identity must subjugate all other identities, all other allegiances, all other affiliations. And I think the problem in much of the modern evangelical movement is there has been a willingness to view one's faith through the prism of one's politics instead of the other way around, and instead of processing everyday political decisions and disputes through the context and through the lens of our faith. And that's the reminder that I'm trying to issue.
And the real goal that so many people enunciate today, and this goes across the political board, is to destroy the opposition rather than to build up your own movement. We will be right back with Tim Alberta, the author of The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory. It's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. And one of the goals that I've tried to honor in this radio show is the goal of maybe helping people with various perspectives understand each other better. And the new book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism, the author is New York Times bestselling author Tim Alberta. This new book is a sensational book precisely because I believe it does help people to understand each other. For people within that one-fourth to one-third of Americans who describe themselves as either born again or evangelical Christians, Tim Alberta, what is it that people from outside the Christian community misunderstand most profoundly about the community in which you were raised and with which you still affiliate?
I'd say a couple of things, Michael. You know, first, when we talk about evangelical Christians, we're talking about tens of millions of people in this country. It is not some monolith. It's not some, you know, I almost hesitate to even call it a subculture. I mean, it's really sort of a culture to its own. And of course, within that culture, you have this vast spectrum of people who have a really diverse array of viewpoints and attitudes and behaviors, especially when it comes to questions of politics. And I think where that gets lost sometimes is if you look at an exit poll and you see, well, you know, 80% of these folks voted for Donald Trump. So that means 80% are, you know, sort of Trump loyalists or Trump enthusiasts or Trump devotees. And obviously, I think that's not the case. You do have a robust portion of these folks who are and would consider themselves to be kind of MAGA diehards. But, you know, I've had so many encounters with so many people across the last 5 years around the country who can give you a fascinating background into how they ultimately wound up voting for Trump. And it felt like a total betrayal of everything they believed in, and they prayed for forgiveness as soon as they left the voting booth, but they did it anyway. And, you know, that may be the other extreme end of the spectrum. But I think what is commonly not well understood is the degree to which I think the popular perception or even caricature is that Trump sort of completely hijacked the evangelical movement. And I think probably a more nuanced window into that world is to see that Donald Trump really tied the movement into knots and has created deep fractures, has caused real lasting rifts in relationships and in sort of institutional partnerships and alliances. And so what I'm describing in the book is less a sort of mass migration of people from one place ideologically to another, and more sort of a look into a civil war, if you will, sort of raging inside American Christendom. And I think, you know, to go one layer deeper, Michael, as far as what people have to understand, because the most common question that I encounter everywhere I go when I'm talking about the book is, well, how could this, why Donald Trump of all people, how could this guy, the thrice married casino owning, we know the whole story, how could he be the one to do this? And I think the most obvious answer that I reached in all of my reporting is just that there is this sense among many evangelicals of impending doom for America, that the country is on its last legs, that their values have come under assault, and that the left, the secular, progressive, humanist, pagan left has basically conquered the institutions of American life, and that if they don't fight back now, that the church as they've known it could collapse. And there's a certain irony here, of course, because they have essentially decided that, well, the barbarians are at the gates, so we need a barbarian to protect us. And in this campaign of theirs to preserve Christian virtue in America, they have turned to someone who is decidedly not virtuous in the Christian ideal. And that is, I think, the obvious moral compromise here that has been made, because to the outside world, they see hypocrisy and they see rank opportunism, and they do not see the Sermon on the Mount. They see the art of the deal. And that is, I think, a stain on the reputation and on the legacy of evangelicalism in this country.
When one of the perspectives of Christianity that I think even people outside the Christian community, and I'm Jewish, I'm not Christian, the idea of forgiveness, love your enemy, those are not ideas that are in line with Trump's current campaign, where he says, I will be your voice, your justice, your retribution. The idea of dealing out retribution to your political enemies, do people really incorporate that as part of their religious perspective?
Well, I think the problem is, Michael, that the religious perspective in this day and age has become in many ways inextricable from the political and cultural and social perspectives. In other words, I think it's become quite difficult for many Christians who are of this mindset, this under siege mindset, and who believe that, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures, and we have to fight back, we have to take the country back, and if that means allying ourselves with the likes of Donald Trump, then so be it. I think that that is not an attitude informed by faith, and certainly not solely by faith. It's an attitude informed by politics and partisanship and sort of cultural ideology, more so than it is of their Christian perspective. And so that is, I think, the problem is that in many ways, I began earlier by talking about identity. And in the New Testament context, the believer's identity is to be so rooted in Christ and in following Christ and in becoming sanctified and more like Christ every day with our behaviors, with our attitudes, with our relationship towards our neighbors and towards our family members and towards our enemies, as you said. That identity should be shaping us all in a way that doesn't necessarily inform the who or the what of politics. Who do you vote for? What policies do you support? But really the how of politics. How do we relate to the world around us? And are we demonstrating love and mercy and grace and forgiveness to the world around us? Or are we demonstrating other things? And I think the obvious, you know, manifest problem and contradiction when allying with Donald Trump is that when he talks about human beings made in the image of God as vermin, or when he talks about immigrants poisoning the blood of the country, or when he uses racist or misogynistic language, it becomes very difficult to reconcile the message of Christ and who we are called to be in that identity with the partisan political identity of, well, we just need to win this next election.
A last question. Exit polling shows that over 80% of self-described evangelical or born-again Christian voters last time voted for President Trump for president. Do you think he will get that same kind of overwhelming support in November's election?
I certainly expect that it will be in that neighborhood, Michael. But let me put a twist on this for a minute, because it's very important to recognize that vote share and raw vote numbers are two different things. And the reason I emphasize that is to say that we have never, in the last 50 years, dealt with a post-Roe v. Wade presidential election. This will be the first. And for millions of evangelicals who consider themselves single-issue pro-life voters, I think for some even fractional number of those folks now, there's a real question of, okay, the issue of abortion is now defederalized, it's thrown back to the states, do I need to hold my nose and vote this way in a presidential election? And if some number of those folks decide to stay home, then that could spell doom for the Trump campaign, even if he wins 80% of all white evangelicals.
Which is a fascinating and important perspective. The book is full of fascinating and important perspectives. It is called The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory. The author is Tim Alberta. I hope we can continue the conversation and you can continue your contributions to this greatest nation on God's green earth.